Acts chapter 23. Paul has completed his third missionary journey. He's come down to Jerusalem with an offering to relieve the Jerusalem church and the people of Jerusalem financially somewhat from some of the poverty that they've experienced and some of the stress they've experienced from famines and things that have hit Jerusalem. And he's brought it down from the Gentile churches, again, trying to bridge that gap between the Gentile believers and the Jewish believers. And he's brought Gentiles with him, Luke and Timothy and some of the others that have come with him. And he's created quite a stir there in Jerusalem. He agreed as another step to try to bridge the gap between the Gentiles and the Jews to take up a vow with a couple of the Jewish believers there in Jerusalem and to go into the temple and to offer sacrifices and to shave his head and take part of this vow that they had taken part of, just so that the Jews there in Jerusalem, the Jewish believers, would be comforted with the fact that in their mind, Paul hadn't gone full renegade on them as far as the Jewish beliefs. You know, James had advised Paul, listen, there's a lot of Jewish believers here. We've got myriads of Jews who've come to Christ, but they still hold to the Jewish traditions. They still circumcise their kids. They still, you know, follow the feast days. They still follow the Jewish eating traditions and all. And he said, they've gotten word that you've turned against that and you're teaching Jews everywhere that they've got to abandon those things in order to follow Christ. So we know you haven't done that. So just to comfort everyone here, go through this Jewish ritual, this Jewish vow with these guys. And so he agreed to do it. You know, Paul said he would be all things to all men so he could win some. Whatever he could do to bring unity and peace to the body of Christ, as long as it didn't compromise basic doctrines, he was willing to do that. And so he enters into the temple and goes there for a few days with these fellows, and they're going through the rituals. And one day he's in there and he gets spotted by some of the Jews that had traveled down for the feast from Asia, some of the areas that Paul had preached in. Some of Paul's opponents from those areas that had started riots in those cities trying to put Paul to death. And so they see Paul and they start screaming, this is the guy that's caused all the trouble all through Asia. He's preaching that the Jews don't have to follow the traditions of Moses. They don't have to circumcise. And so a whole riot breaks out. Paul hadn't done any of those. And the final accusation was he's brought Gentiles into the court of the Jews. We saw the plaque last week that warned any Gentile crossing into Jewish territory there in the temple that their life was in their hands and they would be put to death, and they were responsible for their own lives at that point. So they accused Paul of bringing men into Gentile men into the court of the Jews in violation of Jewish law. And Paul hadn't done it. They'd just seen him with some Gentiles out in the streets in the marketplace. You know, they had no evidence of this, but they accused him of that. So a riot breaks out and they drag Paul out of the temple and they're ready to stone him. And the Roman soldiers realize that there's a riot breaking out in the temple. So they send their soldiers down. They see Paul's in the middle of this thing. They grab him. They drag him out of the temple for his own safety. And as they're taking him up the steps of the Antonia Fortress, he asks, is it okay if I speak to these guys? You know, and so go ahead, you know. So Paul gets up and waves with his hand as he's looking down over the crowds in the courtyard in the temple, and he begins to speak to them in Hebrew. And they start to listen, and he begins to give them his testimony, how he had been raised a Pharisee. An interesting point that he makes to them there, and it'll kind of meld into today's what happens today. He tells them that he was not only a Pharisee, but he was the son of a Pharisee. His father was a Pharisee. And so he says, I was just like you guys. I was zealous for the law. I was zealous for the law of Moses. I was zealous for the tradition of our fathers. And then he tells them how he had had letters, and he was going to Damascus to arrest those believers in the way, bring them back to Jerusalem so they might be punished, thrown in jail, put to death. And then he tells him about the encounter he had on the road to Damascus as the light came down, shone around him, and blinded him. And he cried out and said, "Who are you, Lord?" And he says, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." "Well, what do you want me to do?" "Go into Damascus, and I'll show you from there what you're to do." And so he shares his testimony with them. And he shares with them that the Lord was sending him out with a message. But then he mentioned the dirty word, and he's sending me to the Gentiles. So that's all the Jews had to hear. And we talked about the animosity between the Jews and Gentiles before. Well, now another riot breaks out. He's been speaking in Hebrew, so the Roman soldiers and the Roman commander have no idea what he's been saying. So they grab him and take him into the Antonia fortress, and they're ready to beat him to find out what he said that caused this riot. In their mind, this guy is a rabble-rouser who's trying to rouse up the Jewish people to overthrow Rome. They think he's this guy from Egypt, this assassin from Egypt that's gathered all these people around him. And Paul says, "No, I'm not that. You know, I'm Paul of Tarsus, you know." And he starts to talk to this guy in Greek. And he says, "You know Greek?" "Yeah, I know Greek, you know." And the commander says, "Well, you know, I'm a Roman citizen. I bought my citizenship." And Paul says, "I was born a Roman citizen." Now he's laying on the table, ready to be beaten to death, you know, to get a confession out of him. And they realize he's a Roman. They went, "Oh, we can't beat a Roman without conviction. You know, we can be in big trouble here." So all the guys with their whips and all, they back out. You know, we don't want anything to do with this. And so Paul starts a dialogue with his commander. "Well, I'm a Roman-born citizen, you know." Well, that puts Paul in a whole different perspective to this commander. So he still doesn't know what's going on. So he says, "Well, look, you know, I'm going to keep you overnight. Tomorrow I'll bring in the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin. We'll convene and we'll put you before them, and they can bring the accusations, and we can kind of see what's going on here." And so the next morning, the Roman commander has the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Sanhedrin, their Supreme Court, gather and puts Paul in front of them to speak to them. And they've got the accusations. This man is, you know, preaching against the Jews. He's causing heresy and all these things that he's been accused of. And so Paul begins to speak, and he realizes that part of them are Pharisees and part of them are Sadducees. Sadducees did not believe in anything supernatural. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in any of the miracles in the Old Testament. You know, they held to some of the law, but most of the Old Testament they didn't believe in. The Pharisees believed in angels and the supernatural, and they believed in the resurrection. They believed in the miracles. So Paul gets up and sides with the Pharisees and says, "I'm a Pharisee just like you guys." And he begins to give them his testimony, how the Lord spoke to him and has appeared to him several times and all. And the Pharisees said, "We don't see anything wrong with this guy. You know, if God spoke to him, that's okay with us." Well, the Sadducees start screaming at the Pharisees. The Pharisees start screaming at the Sadducees. The commander says, "You know what? They're going to tear Paul apart." He drags him back out again. And so in the matter of less than 24 hours, Paul has not been the instigator, but he's been the cause of three separate riots now, you know. And this poor commander, he's like, "What? I don't know what to do with this guy. You know, let's put him back in prison again and see what's going on. Figure this thing out." So we left Paul last week in prison after the third riot. Chapter 23 of Acts, verse 11, and we looked at this last week. You know, Paul had gone into Jerusalem with great hopes. We read a couple of weeks ago that he wrote to Romans saying it was his desire that all of Jerusalem, all of Israel, would be saved. In fact, he said, "I would give my salvation in exchange for my Jewish brothers and sisters, if that was possible, that they might find Christ and be saved." Paul knew that this was probably his last visit there. He had spoken to the Ephesian elders up in Miletus and said, "You know, guys, I'm going to Jerusalem, then I want to go to Rome, and then I go to Spain." That was his travel plans. we're never going to see each other again. He's probably also thinking this is his last time in Jerusalem. This is my last shot at sharing the gospel with, you know, my brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. And now it's ended in this. Three riots, no converts, you know. Hasn't been a very successful evangelistic campaign there in Jerusalem for Paul. So he's sitting in the dungeon, sitting in the Antonia fortress in prison. Probably very depressed, very downtrodden, thinking he's a failure. Probably wondering if he should have even come to Jerusalem in the first place. He'd been warned city after city. He was on his way back. This is going to happen to you, Paul. You're going to get arrested. You know, the Jews are going to turn against you. The Gentiles are going to arrest you. You know, you're going to be persecuted. It's not going to be pretty when you get there. And there's Paul sitting there going, you know what? Maybe I should have listened and not gone. You know. So he's really, really down in the dumps. Verse 11 of chapter 23 says, "And the following night the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome.'" You've wanted to go to Rome. You wrote to the Romans and told them you wanted to come. You're going to Rome. So cheer up. You may feel like a failure. You may seem like a failure here, but you've been faithful. Paul would write to the Corinthians and say, it's required of a servant to be faithful. You know, God never requires of us results. That's up to him. That's the work of his Holy Spirit. It's up to us to be faithful, to do whatever God's placed in front of us, to say whatever God's laid on our heart to say. The results are up to him. You know, Paul, you've been faithful. I know your heart. I see your heart. You love these people, but they're stiff-necked. The gospel had been preached for 20 years there in Jerusalem. There had been myriads, as James says, of Jews that had come to Christ. And yet there were those hardcore Jews of the Pharisees and the Sadducees that just wouldn't listen, you know. And they were the ones that Paul wanted because they were the ones that he had associated with, you know. They were the ones he was raised with. They're the ones he went to school with, you know. But they wouldn't listen. But he was faithful. And he tried as hard as he could to share the gospel with them on three different occasions, you know. And it just wasn't there for him at that time. But Paul, you've been faithful to me here. And just as you've testified for me here in Jerusalem, you're going to Rome. You're going to share that same testimony there in Rome. Verse 12. Now things get interesting. "And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath." You know, if you're going to take an oath, be careful what you're binding yourself to. "Saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul." I wonder how many of them actually held to this, because Paul would live for at least another 5 years, you know. Now, there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. And so they come to the chief priests and the elders. Most of these guys were the Sadducees that Paul had tried to address the day before. And they said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near." So here's the picture. These 40 guys get together who have hated Paul. He's maybe even the guys from Asia that were down for the feast. And so they come before the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, and say, "Look, 40 of us have banded together. We're not going to eat or drink anything until Paul's dead. So, and we know you want Paul dead too. So how about if we do this? You send to the Roman commander and say, you know, we'd like to inquire. Our session didn't go so well yesterday. So we want another chance to talk to Paul. get some more information out of him. So you bring him down here. And these guys were going to lay in wait and ambush him and take him out. And so that's the plan. Verse 16. So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, first of all, we didn't know until the last chapter that Paul's dad was a Pharisee. Now we find out that Paul's got a sister who lives in Jerusalem that has a son, right? So Paul's sister's son hears about the ambush. And I was thinking to myself, and I have no biblical backing for this, but I like to kind of connect dots. Paul's dad was a Pharisee. Paul was a Pharisee trained in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. Paul's sister's living in Jerusalem, and she's got a young son who just happens to overhear what's going on there in the Supreme Court. I'm almost wondering if he was in Pharisee school. You know, they started teaching them really early because they had to memorize the scriptures. They had to memorize all the laws, all the traditions of the elders, you know, all these things they had to memorize as young boys as they were growing up being taught as Pharisees. I kind of have a suspicion that he's following in his grandfather's footsteps and his uncle Paul's footsteps. It was actually Saul at the time. But I sort of suspect he's in Pharisee school. And that would be the reason why he would be in the Sanhedrin. You know, and so he overhears this discussion of these 40 guys coming in. Hey, here's the plan, you know. So he's, you know, wait a minute, I think I heard Paul's name mentioned. He probably got a little closer and started taking notes, you know. I don't know. But that's kind of my surmising. You know, I might be totally wrong on that, but there's a reason why he happened to be there at that time. And seems logical to me. But anyway, Paul's sister's son, and he's not an old guy at this time. You know, he's not a full-grown man, as we'll see. He's still a young boy, but, you know, they would have started him at 10, 11, 12 in Pharisee school if some, you know, if a young boy showed promise. And he's got a heritage. Grandpa was a Pharisee. Uncle Paul's a Pharisee. You know, maybe his dad was even a Pharisee when he was alive. We don't know. But there he is. And he hears about this plan, this plot, put Paul to death. And he went and he entered the barracks. So he runs over to the Antonia fortress and he's allowed to get in and see Paul. And he tells Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." And so he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Now, here's how you can tell this was a young guy. And the commander took him by the hand. You know, if you got a 17 or 20-year-old guy, you're not going to take his hand and take him aside. You know, if you got a 10 or 11-year-old kid, you're going to, "Come on, son, let's go over here and talk," you know. So he's probably a little guy at this point. So he takes him aside privately, verse 19, and says, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat or drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." Roman commanders, Roman governors, Roman procurators, and all those different leadership titles throughout the Roman Empire had one main job: keep the peace. Rome did not like uprisings. But also, you protect the Roman citizens. So this commander has two jobs: keep the peace with Jerusalem, keep Paul protected. He fails on either one of those two, and his head's on the chopping block. So he's kind of quelled the riots for a little bit of time. He's got Paul in prison, But he's also got to keep Paul protected. So he's listening to this young guy going, okay, I can't let Paul go there and lose him. Now I've, you know, they've put the death of a Roman citizen on my watch. I'm in deep trouble. So he's got to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with this? So the commander, verse 22, let the young man depart, and commanded him, saying, don't tell anyone that you have told me these things. Let them think that this is the plan. You know, don't say anything to anyone. Then he calls for two centurions. Now, centurion was someone who was a commander over 100 people. This commander, in the Latin, his title was Tribunal Max, Milianus or something like that, which meant commander over 1,000. So he's got about 1,000 soldiers there in the Antonia fortress, especially during the time of the feast, when that was the biggest time that an uprising could take place there in Jerusalem. So he's probably got 1,000 guys there. So he calls two centurions to him. He probably had 10 under his command, but he calls two of them to him and said, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. So he's going to get Paul out of town, but he's going to make sure Paul gets out of there safely. He's got 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen. So there's a contingent of 470 guys around Paul. There's no way 40 guys are getting through this, you know. And you're leaving at night. The third hour of the night would have been about 9 p.m. The Jewish day generally went from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then the evening would start. So the third hour of the night would be 9 o'clock at night. So they're going to do this at night. And he's making sure that Paul gets out safely. And provide mounts to set Paul on. So Paul's going to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. Felix would have been in Caesarea. Caesarea is about 60 miles northwest on the Mediterranean coast. It was where the Roman governor presided. Herod the Great, who was alive when Jesus was born, had built a palace for himself in Caesarea that the Romans used for the Roman governor. And it was like Club Med, you know, it was on the Mediterranean, it was a beautiful place, there was a big amphitheater there, they had Roman-type games there, it was a Roman city, basically. And it was built in honor of Caesar. That was why it was called Caesarea. So the Romans were stationed up there, even though they had a contingent in Jerusalem. The Romans that were in charge of Palestine had their fortresses up there. The Roman governor was up there. It was the safest place to send Paul and still have him a captive. And so they're going to send him 60 miles north to Caesarea. And so the commander writes a letter to Felix the governor, and he writes Claudius Lysias. So we now know that that's the name of the commander. To the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. And coming with troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Now, he's going to shade this a little bit to make himself look good. He's not going to tell this Roman governor that I was about to beat a Roman citizen when he told me he was Roman, you know. So he's going to go, well, I found out he was Roman, so we rushed in and rescued him, you know. So he's bending the truth a little bit, you know, just to make himself look good, take some of the heat off of himself. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. And I found that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And the Romans really wanted peace. And one of the things that they did was they gave the different countries that they had conquered latitude as far as the way they wanted to worship. And they gave them some leeway in how to govern themselves and all. And so matters of Jewish law, the Romans weren't really concerned. Now, look, you deal with your own religious stuff, you know. We'll get involved if it's something that's against Rome, but you deal with your own religious stuff. You know, so he says, there's nothing that this man's been accused of that has caused him to deserve death under Roman law. It's all Jewish religious stuff that they're fighting over. Because I had to rescue the guy because he's a Roman citizen. And when it was told to me that the Jews lay in wait for this man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. And so up with Paul goes this letter with one of the centurions, kind of explaining the truth. But, you know, here's why you're getting this guy. He was threatened down here. There's stuff against him that doesn't deserve death as far as Rome's concerned. But I had to get him out of town because they were going to put him to death. And so I'm sending him to you, but I've also sent word to the council here in Jerusalem that if they want to bring accusation, they've got to come and see you, basically. So he's passed the buck now to Felix, you know. And finally, this guy is out from under my watch, and I'm okay, you know. I dodged a bullet. So verse 31, the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Antipatris is a city that's about 30 miles north of Jerusalem. They had traveled through the Judean countryside, which was a lot of hills and a lot of places that were dangerous. And there could have been ambushes along the way. So the 470 soldier contingent takes Paul as far as Antipatris. And at that point, from there to Caesarea, it's pretty wide open, and you can see if you know, you're going to be ambushed and all. So they didn't need quite so many people there. So the next day, they left the horsemen to go on with him, and they returned to the barracks. And so the foot soldiers and all went back to the barracks, and the horsemen took Paul on to Caesarea. Now, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers also have come. You know, Paul was from Tarsus, which was north of Caesarea. But it was the main city in the Roman province of Cilicia. So Cilicia being a Roman province, the Roman governor would still have jurisdiction there. So he would be able to rule on a case involving a Roman citizen from Cilicia. So that's why he asked, where are you from? I'm from Cilicia. Okay, I've got jurisdiction here, so I'll listen to your accusers and hear you when they come. And so he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. And this is in the palace that Herod had built for himself that now was being occupied by the Romans. And now after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullius. And they gave evidence to the governor against Paul. So now from Jerusalem comes this contingent of these men from the Sanhedrin. The high priest comes, and of course they probably had this big entourage of, you know, coming into town. And they bring a lawyer who is very well spoken. They call him an orator. I should take some lessons. To speak on their behalf, to present their case before Felix. This is probably, you know, their top prosecutor. And so Felix pulls them together. It says, when he was called upon, Tertullius began his accusation. And he starts out by flattering Felix. Now, this was normal in when you were presenting a case. Whoever you're addressing, if he was a judge or in high position, you always praised him. But this guy's praise went way beyond the truth. Felix wasn't this good. But he's trying to butter him up to get on his good side. And so Tertullius starts out saying, seeing that through you we have enjoyed peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. The reality it was, Felix had been, this is about 57 AD at this point. Felix had been governor over Palestine for about 5 years. During his period in office, there had been all kinds of uprisings against the Romans. The Roman commander back in Jerusalem had thought Paul was an assassin from Egypt. These assassins were a group that started during Felix's reign and were reaping havoc all over Palestine, attacking Romans and causing insurrections. And so this guy says, oh, we've enjoyed wonderful peace, you know, under your rule. And in reality, it was chaos going on, you know. But he's trying to get on the good side of this guy. You know, we've been prosperous under you. You know, we've had peace under you. And it's been far from the truth. In fact, we'll see in another later on in the chapter that 2 years from now, the Jews will have complained so much to Caesar Nero that Felix gets pulled because he's caused so many problems. But anyway, he's trying to get on Felix's good side. Verse 4, nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, you know, I flattered you enough, you know, I don't want to, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, speaking of Paul, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout all the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. So they bring three accusations against Paul. First of all, he's created dissension among the Jews all over the world. And it was really, Paul hadn't. It was the Jews that had stirred themselves up, you know. Paul was just teaching them in the synagogues, and they just, uprisings would start. And he was teaching them their own scriptures, showing them that Jesus was the Messiah out of their own scriptures, you know. But it was the hard-headed, stiff-necked Jews that wouldn't listen that created all the problems. So it wasn't Paul doing that, first of all. Then he says he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Of course, they're referring to Jesus of Nazareth. And they looked at these Christians as being a sect, a heresy of Judaism. And so they were calling them the sect of the Nazarenes because they were following this Nazarene named Jesus. And so he's one of their ringleaders. Yeah, that's sort of true if you want to go that way. But then the third thing is what Paul was accused of down in Jerusalem. We know that he hadn't done this. He even tried to profane the temple, of course, by bringing Gentiles in. And that's when we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But Lysias came in and with great violence took him out of our hands. So this guy's really good. So that's the accusation. And they don't bring any evidence. They bring the accusations. They don't bring any witnesses because they don't have any that could tell the truth, you know, and support their side of it. And so they say, if you question this man, then he'll incriminate himself, and you'll see that we're right if you question him. So they think, you know, if they pressure Paul, they can get him to confess to these things. Verse 10. Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, "Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge over this nation," you know, Paul's going to kind of do the same thing and flatter the guy, but truthfully. He says, for many years now, you've been a judge over our nation. He doesn't say he's been a good judge, but you've been a judge over our nation. I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. You know, he says, all this happened in just 12 days. Felix, you know. So there's not a lot here to deal with. They found me in the temple. Let me read that again. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city. Paul says, I was going into the temple, minding my own business, fulfilling the Jewish law of taking this Jewish vow. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't dispute with anybody. I didn't cause any kind of issues. He says, nor can they prove the things which they now accuse me of. They've got no evidence of these accusations. I'm innocent. But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers. You know, he's bringing it back to their Jewish law. I'm accused of violating the Jewish law. What I'm doing is I'm fulfilling the Jewish law. I have a better understanding of the Jewish law than they do. You know, it's kind of what he's putting out here. He says, but this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets. I believe the whole of the Old Testament scriptures. They're only believing the part they want to believe. I believe the whole of the scriptures. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead. Of course, they didn't accept that part. Both of the just and the unjust. Paul's saying the Old Testament scriptures talk about that, and they do. He says, and I believe that, and that's what my hope is in. This being so, I myself always strive to have a good conscience without offense towards God and men. You know, I don't try to offend God, and I don't try to offend men. I always have a good conscience and strive to have a good conscience. Now, after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation. You know, I've been away for a long time. Now I brought gifts back from these Gentile nations and Gentile churches to this nation. In the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with a tumult. I was there with a couple of guys. You know, we're going through this purification ritual, and they found me. They ought to have been here before you to object if they have anything against me. You know, these guys who started all this should be here testifying. Now, even the Sanhedrin got it second and third hand. You know, they weren't eyewitnesses. So Paul says the guys that caused all this should be the ones that are here. Where are they? Why aren't they here? Or else let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me. Well, I stood before the council, unless it is for this one statement, which I cried out standing among them concerning the resurrection of the dead. I am being judged by you this day. He says, that's the only thing I said that caused the problem when I was standing in front of the council. He said, if I said anything else, then let them come forth and testify against me. You know, he's pleading totally innocent here. I am innocent of all of this stuff that I've been accused of. They don't even have evidence or eyewitness testimony to anything that they're accusing me of. But when Felix heard these things, having a more accurate knowledge of the way, interesting statement there by Luke. He says, Felix had a more excellent understanding of the way. Paul had been preaching in many of the Roman cities, you know, throughout Asia and Greece and the different places. And he had been challenged and taken to court in many of these places. And so it seems that Rome had kind of put out a message to the different governors and all that if you encounter something going on with the way, here's Rome's position on it. And it seems that, you know, they were willing to let them have some leeway as long as there weren't any problems caused, you know. And so here Luke says, Felix had a more excellent understanding, a more accurate understanding or knowledge of the way. probably from some correspondence he'd gotten from Rome. And he adjourned the proceedings and said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case. And so he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for him or to visit him. And so he doesn't have enough evidence here to rule against Paul. To rule against Paul. But he's not willing to let Paul go and stir up trouble with the Jews. So now he's sort of between a rock and a hard place, because he doesn't want to create an issue with the Jews. He's already been in hot water with them all along. You know, they've been writing letters to Rome saying this guy's judges unfairly. You know, he's a money grubber and all this stuff. And we'll look at that in a little bit. So he doesn't want to get the Jews riled up against him. But on the flip side, he's got nothing to really hold Paul on. So he's, again, not sure what to do here. So he says, well, I'll hear from Lysias, the commander. In the meantime, Paul, I'm going to keep you here. But you're going to have a lot of freedom here. I'm not going to keep you bound in chains. Your friends can come. They can bring you food and provisions. You know, you got the run of the castle, you know. And so that was his decision. And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith of Christ. Now, Drusilla was Jewish. Now, Felix had been married three times. The first wife he had was the daughter of Cleopatra and Anthony. So that was his first wife. This wife, his third wife, is one of the daughters of a previous Herod, you know, so she's Jewish. So she wants to hear Paul. So he brings his wife, and they sit down and they listen to Paul, and Paul shares the gospel with them. He says she shares concerning the faith in Christ. Now, as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, which is one of the Felix's issues, you know, he's on his third wife, so he probably didn't have a lot of self-control, and judgment to come, Felix was afraid. He's under conviction. And he answered, go away for now. When I have a more convenient time, I will call for you. So Paul's sharing the gospel, and he's warning him. He says, you know, if you're a true believer in Christ, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. You know, you've been married three times. And it was almost harkens back to John the Baptist and Herod, you know, when he had taken his brother's wife, you know, and John had gotten on his case about that, you know. Herod liked to listen to him, but he's, you know, he didn't like the conviction he was under. Here, this guy, when Paul starts talking about judgment to come, he gets under conviction. You know, he says, okay, Paul, I've heard enough. You know, I'll talk to you when it's more convenient. And so he lets him go. But then you get a little bit of insight into this guy, and we're going to finish with the next two verses. Meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given to him by Paul, that he might be released. He's looking for a bribe. So if Paul sits here long enough, sooner, you know, he's going to break down and just say, you know what, let me give you, you know, a half a million drachmas to get me out of here, or whatever the price was. You know, he's looking for a bribe. And that was one of the complaints that the Jews had against him, was he judged unfairly, and he was always looking for money. So he was, you know, you could bribe a judgment out of this guy. So he's sitting there with Paul in prison waiting for the money, you know. So meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given to him by Paul, that he might release him. Therefore, he sent for him more often and conversed with him. So he's bringing Paul up more and more to talk to him, but he's actually trying to get the money out of Paul, you know. If I see this guy long enough, maybe he's just going to give me some money to get out of here. God bless you. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix. So finally, Nero's gotten enough complaints against Felix and said, all right, I'm replacing this guy. And so he sends down another governor, Porcius Festus, and he succeeds Felix. But Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, leaves Paul bound. So he still doesn't want to go out ticking off the Jews, and so he leaves Paul bound. Now Paul is Festus' problem, and so we will leave it there for today. But just an interesting trip through Paul's life. So next week, read chapter 25 and 26, and we'll be moving on to Rome shortly. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for